Our next speaker will be Dave Charbonneau of Harvard. He's going to be speaking on a transitory overview.
Okay. When I accepted the invitation to speak, they asked, could you please give a review of transits? And I said, oh, that sounds great. And then I saw the schedule and I saw that really, arguably, most of this meeting is about transits. Okay? And at least the next 24 hours of speakers are all speaking specifically about observations of transiting systems where you have both the Doppler and the photometric signal. And then arguably the next 2 or 3 days of talks, leaning more towards the theorists, are talking about observables that come from those systems. So that put me in a somewhat awkward position. And also the field is moving so quickly that I find that the comments that I might make go stale quite quickly. And so that's the purpose of this title is with the best of wishes that what I have to say to you won't be useful to you for very long. Okay, in a nutshell, here's how I see it. So in really the last decade, almost exactly to the day, really, we had the discovery of the first transiting system, HD209458, 1999. And then basically, I think the last 10 years have been this, from the point of view of the transiteers, have been this wonderful adventure in reminding ourselves of all the things you get from eclipsing binaries. And you know, the idea that you get direct constraints on the mass and radius of these objects. We came up with clever ways to study the atmospheres. We thought about multiple systems. We thought about the Rossiter-McLaughlin effect. All this wonderful stuff that you're going to hear about applied to planetary systems. And then fall of 2009, we had the first transiting super-Earths. Okay, and so you know, part of the I would say an underlying theme to the next 30 minutes here is you know taking this experience and looking forward and anticipating what we might do in the years to come. And so, if you're a graduate student here, you know I was a graduate student here. Okay, and I used to go to these talks and think, oh, that's really exciting. And so I think there's just these wonderful opportunities, and that I think I'm, you know, it's a little sad. I think that the those of you who are just starting grad school now, you're going to be the ones who, maybe as part of your thesis, get to participate in the discovery of the first truly rocky worlds in the habitable zones of nearby stars, and that's just phenomenally interesting. So for you, I just want to, you know, if this is one of the first exoplanet meetings you're going to, it's important to remind ourselves why we care so much about transiting systems. And the point is that you get the masses and radii virtually without astrophysical assumption. And I think in astronomy, we are too frequently in the position of accepting layers of astrophysical assumptions that have been published and built up and not questioned over time. And here we're using Newton's version of Kepler's third law. Okay, there is one hidden underlying assumption, which is some guesstimate of the stellar mass. Okay, it's not a double-line spectroscopic binary. But nonetheless, you know, you can actually get masses and radii, and so you can make inferences about the composition of these objects. And then also, these systems are the ones that are permitting us to go ahead and learn about the atmospheres of these planets. And those atmospheric studies have proven so penetrating because the masses and radii are determined virtually without astrophysical assumptions. So when we're studying the molecules in the atmosphere of a planet, the fact that we don't have to let the mass or the radius or the insulation or the stellar luminosity or the planet-star distance be free parameters, the fact that those are all determined generally to within a few percent, maybe 10%, means that the things that we're learning about the atmospheres are much more penetrating. And so then I'm going to anticipate how we might move forward really in the next 5 years. Okay, so viewed differently, this is the mass radius diagram for all known exoplanets, gas giants in the universe for which we could put them on this plot as of 1999. And then we leap ahead 10 years, and that's what you have. So 10 years of very hard work. You're going to hear a lot about that from other speakers. Basically, I've filled in this diagram. Even by 2006, we thought maybe we were just finding analogs of the solar system, hot analogs of the solar system gas giants with masses and radii similar to Jupiter and Saturn. But then afterwards, we found many things which were truly offensive to our models, as well as objects that should have been easier to find, right? These should be easier because they're more massive. So it's easier to detect or confirm the radial velocities. Yet we did not publish them until later. And then, of course, the appearance of the first move down in this part of the diagram, which will preoccupy me here today. But I should mention, of course, that there's this basic problem that the theorists have not done their job, which is that they haven't explained the radii that we observe. And you can fuss at me, but you haven't done your job. We've done our job. You have to come up. The point is that if you believe you understand the equation of state of hydrogen and helium, okay, then you should be able to tell me the radius of an object given its mass, okay? And you can't. I know. I'm simplifying, but you can't because what you've done instead is you've then come up with ideas of how to inject additional energy into the bulk of the planet to retard its contraction. Okay, and that's great, but it's not predictive. So I want to get to the point where I can say, hey, I found a new transiting planet, and then you can ask me any question you want. You can say, what's the oxygen abundance of the star's atmosphere? What's the age and what's the luminosity of the star? Whatever, yes, you could ask me those questions, and then I can answer that question. That's great, and I will answer those questions, and then you should be able to predict the radius, okay? And until you can do that, I don't think it's really satisfying. It's exciting to think about these ideas, but it's not very satisfactory. Pardon me? Why it's puffy? Well, that's why there's all these models to explain why they're puffy. And they all have to do with the proximity of the planet to the star. So you're all assuming that we got it right for Jupiter. And then you're saying there's something to do with being so close to the star that generates this additional energy source. It could be a tidal effect. It could be making use of the stellar insulation, whatever it is. And that's why I was so pleased to finally see this guy, Corot 9, a major step forward, because it's the first non-weird transiting planet we have out of 66. Okay, because it's in a circular orbit, it's a gas giant, but it's far enough from its star, it's a 95-day orbital period. The periastron distance is 0.36, I think, AU, point, yeah, 0.36. And so the point is it's far enough from its star and stays far enough from its star that you can't invoke any of those mechanisms. So it better be consistent with your models that were tuned to match Jupiter and Saturn. And lo and behold, it is. And so if we have a few more of those, then I feel more comfortable about you tuning things. This was one of the beautiful planets found by Corot, which I'll talk about briefly. There's the transit, here's the radial velocity curve. And then here's an understanding of the radius of the planet given its age and, of course, its measured mass. And then lo and behold, the best fit models have something like a 0 to 20 Earth mass core surrounded by an envelope of hydrogen helium enriched by the solar abundance. Great. Okay. I want to, at times for my talk, bring your attention to exciting developments that I see happening for the first time because we want to anticipate them. One of them is this wonderful result that we are soon going to be in the position of having the astroseismic modes detected for the host star that also has planets that transit. And that's really neat. And why it's neat is that astroseismology to the mean stellar density, okay? Because those frequencies tell you about the sound speed, which tells you about the density of the medium. And the transits tell you the mean stellar density independently. And so those two had better match. And so I was involved in this proposal led by Ron Gilland. When all the other instruments were down except FGS, Ron said, let's use FGS on HST. Let's stare at this known transiting system, HD17156, for 10 days, and then also get three additional transits outside of that window. It's a 21-day transiting planet. And then Ron did the analysis, also working with a graduate student who worked with me, Philip Nutzman. Here's the time series. It's terrible. It's corrupted. You can see all this signal. That's just the orbit of HST. And we do our thing. We do our job. And then we clean it up. Okay. And then you get what looks like noise. And then when you take a power spectrum, you see those astroseismic modes. Okay. And so these papers have been submitted. And I want to show Philip's work was to here's the uncorrected data. And then when you correct it for the modulation induced by HST due to its changing illumination as it orbits the Earth, you get this nice light curve. But the point is that the transit photometry yields a density of 0.522 plus or minus 0.019. Astroseismology is consistent but more precise. What this gives you is, first of all, the two independent, the check on the mean stellar density, but also gives you an age, right? And this age is very important because, after all, these planets are contracting. over time? And so an age is presumably something the theorist you'd like to know. That'd be one of those questions you'd ask me. The radius of the planet is measured to about 0.6%, and that includes the systematic uncertainties contributed by our lack of knowledge of the mass of the star. That's what astroseismology does for you. So it's an exquisite measurement of the radius and therefore density of this body. Okay, so just some thoughts on the constraints on the structural models. Here, we're going to just briefly mention that, of course, you get you have an opportunity to go ahead and study the atmospheres of planets. One idea is when the planet goes in front of the star, some light from the star goes through the outer atmosphere of the planet, imprinted on that are absorption features. You see those appear during transit. Great, you can detect molecules. When the planet goes out of view behind the star, you don't get to see the planet. That's a wonderful thing, because what you want to do is separate the light from the planet and the light from the star. So you want to get the planet out of there, take your infrared spectrum, let the planet come back into view, repeat the measurement, and subtract them. And the light that's left over is the light from the planet. Okay, so those are two ways that we have to actually study the atmospheres of these bodies. And again, these are systems for which we know all, you know, everything about the luminosity of the star generally, and the radii and separation and so on. And so the two real workhorses in this endeavor for transmission spectroscopy, primarily HST, for secondary eclipses, primarily the Spitzer Space Telescope. I am not going to summarize all of this. There are entire talks devoted to this. I just want to show some representative slides. Here's a paper that I was part of with Adam Burrows and Carl Grillmer, where basically you have IRAC photometry complemented by spectroscopy with IRS. Basically, you're measuring the planet-to-star flux ratio as a function of wavelength. The point is, this is not a Planck curve. Okay, you can see modulation in here, which is due primarily to the presence of opacity induced by water. This slope basically tells you about the pressure-temperature profile in the atmosphere. And Spitzer was a real workhorse. Basically, every instrument we can, we threw at it, and it just delivered wonderful data. Looking ahead to studying more Earth-like planets with JWST, I want to point out that we almost screwed this one up. We almost missed this. Okay, so, you know, Spitzer, nay, Cirdev. Cirdev was about to launch, and there was one transiting planet. Okay, and it just happened that the ground-based surveys really got going in time. Even by the time half the cryogen was depleted, there were only 9 of them, or 8 of them. Okay, so we almost missed this. It was really just in the last dying years of Spitzer, the last year or two, that we got the most of our data coming in. And Spitzer ran out of cryogen, and now we just have the two warm band passes. So I would hate for us to not learn from that experience. Okay, and then transmission spectroscopy. Up means opacity in these plots as a function of wavelength. Some nice work by Swain and collaborators showing modulation due to water and arguing for methane as well. And then a paper I was part of with Frederick Paul showing that in the optical it's pretty flat. That could be due to hazes. Again, these are meant to be representative. Okay, just showing you that. And these are all, I happen to do this all for the same system, HD189733. Okay, so, you know, there are clear detection of many different molecules. We think we can see clouds. We certainly think we're seeing temperature inversions due to whether or not you're seeing absorption or emission features. And we're even learning about the day-night contrast. And we'll hear a lot of this, particularly by Heather Knutson, who will speak soon. Okay. All right, so summarizing, here's how I see it. Transit detection, generally done from the ground, followed by a mass determination, again, done by the ground, and then atmospheric characterization done with NASA's great observatories from space. I'm okay with permuting these two. Okay, many of the ones that have been most fruitful were first radial velocity detections. But the idea is ground-based mass and radius detection of bright systems, and then you point the most powerful observatories ever built towards them. I do want to bring your attention to this very, very interesting development, which is really just in the last month we've seen a flurry of publications of ground-based detections of the secondary eclipse. Okay, so you're actually able to fight through all the telluric variability to see the light from the planet in the presence of all this confounding noise. I just pulled out, you know, just cutting and pasting from people's AstroPH, or in Bryce's case from his webpage, plots. Bryce Kroll using CFHT, Dumouge was using WHT for this, Rogers at the APO. The point is these are graduate students who are going and using the, you know, mid-sized telescopes with infrared photometers that they have to just go and do this. Okay, so that, you know, it's a big, why didn't we do it before? Why couldn't we get it to work? Maybe field of view? I don't know. Why it's important is that most of the Spitzer observations, if you plot planet versus star as a function of wavelength. Spitzer looks good, looks great, but actually if you plot it and try to figure out where most of the energy is coming out, if you actually just plot the actual flux, Spitzer is just in the tail. So if you want to do things like actually add up all the emission from the planet and see if it matches the light hitting the planet, okay, which would be very interesting, then you actually need, well, lo and behold, it's 1 to 2 microns. So it's ground-based stuff. So people have got to figure out how to do JHK. And then what I want to see us do is actually integrate this and see if the planets are on budget. In the solar system, what fraction of the gas and ice giants are on budget? No, well, no. Once you include Kelvin-Helmholtz contraction, yeah. With only one in four, right? Actually, the emission from the gas and ice giants match the absorbed stellar radiation. Okay? So only for Uranus. For Neptune, Saturn, and Jupiter, you need an additional source of energy. They put out more energy than they receive. We think that that's ongoing contraction. We're not really sure. We don't really know what's different for Uranus. Okay? Interesting. Or at least this is what the planetary scientists tell me at Harvard. Okay, and then how are we going to go and do it for habitable planets? Okay, so the difficulty for habitable planets is that the planets are really small. And to put it to scale, there's the sun, there's the thing you want to look at, let alone study its atmosphere, not the spots. Okay, but what we have going for us is this result that we're hearing debated, that there's this large population of what we're calling super Earths. And I just mean things that are 2 to 10 times the mass of the Earth. We didn't know what they were made of. Okay. And the HARPS team was saying 30 to 50%. Maybe we were hearing the numbers are slightly lower, but a testable hypothesis, what transits can contribute is tell you whether these things are really kind of small Neptunes or whether they're big Earths. Are they balls of silicate? Or are they icy worlds enshrouded by hydrogen and helium? You can only answer that question by measuring their average densities. So what we want to do is go and find some more rocky planets. I'm going to outline three approaches. One approach is to stare at known transiting systems. Basically, transiting hot Jupiters and hot Neptunes are basically telling you, hey, I'm an edge-on planetary system. Come look at me. And then you can scan the equatorial plane, assuming all the planets are on roughly the same plane, with good precision to actually identify transiting small bodies. And so what a group of us did is we used the repurposed the Deep Impact spacecraft for the epoxy mission. And the first component of epoxy is to go and look at known transiting exoplanet systems to do exquisite photometry to see if we can see additional planets passing in front of the star or dynamically perturbing the times of transit of the known giant planet. And so we did that for 7 systems. Here's our data for GJ-436. There was an incredible amount of work that was done by Sarah Ballard and Jesse Christensen, who's now just moved out to join the Kepler team at Ames. Sarah's a graduate student. Basically, this is the photometry that comes out of the Deep Impact pipeline. Of course, they were interested in imaging. They weren't interested in doing precise photometry. Those two individuals did incredible work. And then you got this exquisite photometry of GJ-436. If you bin it down, okay, it does bin down, it doesn't quite recapture the Poisson limit, but it does get you down to almost 10 to the minus 5 relative precision. Okay, and then what Sarah has done and has published, is submitted and posted on AstroPH, is showing that basically she can show you that there's no planet and that her sensitivity is down to 1.5 Earth radii. Okay, so for those of you who care about 436, you know that it's eccentric and maybe that's a puzzle and maybe it points to another planet. Well, here we can place very tight constraints on that planet, assuming that it transits. Okay, now there's always the possibility that it's at large orbital separations and just doesn't happen to clip the star. Okay, and so what Sarah was able to do is basically show that she can rule out really terrestrial type bodies, and then also she identified this kind of intriguing candidate signal which we're pursuing. Okay, plan number two. That was plan number one, kind of limited to a certain number of stars, but we were making progress. Plan number two, build your own spacecraft. And so Corot and Kepler did that, of course, and we're going to hear a lot about them. Kepler is working very, very well. This is the 6-hour precision, log 10 ppm. So as a function of Kepler magnitude, the green point, each green point here is a dwarf. And a red point is a giant, showing that the folks who built the Kepler Input Catalog did a pretty good job because of the the giant. They wanted to throw out the giants because they were variable. These are the dwarfs. The point is that Kepler is working very, very well and getting beautiful precision to get down to its goal of finding Earth analogs. Kepler has published a gaggle of planets so far, and presumably there are more to come. But these are the gas giants. What we're all really interested in is finding the smaller bodies that are primarily rock and ice. And so, of course, this is the photometry of the known exoplanet HAT-P7. This is the primary eclipse, and this is when the planet goes behind the star. But I simply show it to point out that this signal is a part in 10 to the minus, a part in 10 to the 4, a part in 10,000, which is the same as the signal of a Earth-sized thing passing in front of a Sun-like star. Okay, so at least at short periods, this sort of proves to you that Kepler is doing its job. The question is, can they do that out at one-year periods? I think so. They're pretty clever. I think they can. So, but the thing we have to get used to is that it ain't going to be easy in terms of how would you prove that a signal like that really was a planet? Okay, we're not going to have the luxury of measuring the acceleration of the star, i.e., the radial velocity wobble. So we have to really get used to this idea that we have to come up with other methods of proving to ourselves that the only viable hypothesis is a transiting planet. So we have to rule out astrophysical false positives, so combinations of eclipsing binaries that precisely mimic the light curve. And so I think one way to make progress is for these two observatories to get together, Kepler and Spitzer, Worm Spitzer. And the idea is what you can do is that when you have a candidate, and here I'm showing work done by François Fressin with Corot 7. This is the Corot light curve. What François does is he runs software created by Willy Torres to match the depth observed in the visible, in the optical, with Corot, and then predicts what the signal would be at Spitzer wavelengths. The idea is if it's a blend, then because the stars have slightly different temperatures, if you go out to infrared wavelengths, then the depth changes. So suddenly this gives you a discriminant for systems where you're not going to have the luxury of getting the radial velocity directly. And what now in the case of Crow 7, they did have the radial velocities, okay? But that's not going to generally be true for most of the terrestrial candidates identified by Kepler at longer periods. And even if there's just not enough integration time, and systematic noise sources are going to cut us off. Okay, and so we got Worm Spitzer data showing that we could rule out that alternate scenario, which in that case produced a deeper eclipse. So it's a strong argument in favor of this being a planet, and then a weak confirmation of the planetary signal, but I'm not emphasizing that here. Okay, so then I just want to briefly look ahead at the path for Kepler-detected worlds. So if you want to go after so Kepler is fabulous for telling us about the rate of occurrence of rocky bodies and therefore how common we are, right? Earth-like systems at 1 AU from a Sun-like star. The transit detections from space, the mass determination may or may not be done from the ground. There's some hope that we really could get there. But you really can't go after the atmospheres. That's just out of the question for those systems. Okay, so the alternate way to proceed is to look at M-dwarfs. I'm a big fan. You hear me asking questions up front about M-dwarfs. I'm really on about M-dwarfs these days. Habitable zones of M-dwarfs are shrunken and close, bad for imaging. That's great for transits. Everything goes in your favor. Why does everything go in your favor? Well, let's put a super Earth around an M-dwarf and compare it to a Sun-like star. Okay, the transits are deep because the star is small. So the transit is up to 1% in depth. That's what we've been doing for 10 years with hot Jupiters. Transits are more frequent. That's just because the habitable zone is at short orbital periods. So that if you're in the habitable zone of an M-dwarf, you go around once every 10 days instead of once a year. The transits are more likely. That's different. That's not the same idea. And that's just because you're in close, so there's a wider range of angles that bring you in front of the star. And also, there's a greater Doppler wobble. Okay, so it's easier to actually measure the masses, assuming you can get to the same precision. And I wanted to show some very nice recent work by Jacob Bean using TRIRES on the VLT, where basically Jacob was showing that at infrared wavelengths, he can get 3 to 5 meters a second on late M-dwarfs. And so that's a big breakthrough, I think. Okay, so working with Colin Blake, who's here, we worked for several years trying to do that with NearSpec, admittedly on more troublesome L-dwarfs, and really only getting to sort of 100 meters a second in the best of cases, maybe for the M-dwarfs 50, to really see this go down. And what Jacob did was build an ammonia cell, which he put in front of the path, so really inspired by the success of the iodine cell technique, to convert an existing spectrograph into a very precise radial velocity machine, which seemed to work very well. So I'm incredibly excited about this. One thing he did along the way was rule out the astrometric candidate VB10. Okay, so for So for our job moving forward to try to find these planets that we are, for which we are going to be able to study the atmosphere spectroscopically, is to find them passing in front of very, very small stars, okay, and nearby stars. So what we decided to do was to create a list of all the nearby M dwarfs and survey them so that we can actually detect a planet in the habitable zone of those M dwarfs, provided that the planet was a super Earth big, meaning maybe twice the size of the Earth. Okay? And so that's called the MIRTH project. And so what we did is we took over this existing observatory, which was a Cold War era building built for satellite monitoring, at Mount Hopkins, is about an hour south of Tucson, and we filled it full of these telescopes, eight of them to be exact. And the idea is it's different from all other transit surveys in that we don't look at a fixed field of view. The telescopes look at the whole sky, and I have a time-lapse movie, which hopefully will play. Okay, so what the telescopes, there's eight telescopes here. There's a fisheye lens sitting on the floor of the dome. And the idea here is you have to get used to the fact that the telescopes are each following something like 10 or 15 stars over the course of a night, and then as they set, they pick up new stars. And each integration time is completely optimized because a star of a luminosity has a different habitable zone orbital period and has a different radius, and so you have to figure out exactly the cadence and sensitivity you need for each observation. There's a brilliant guy who's done all that named Jonathan Irwin. And so this is basically MIRTH in action. Okay, and so you can see that if you follow any one of these systems, you'll notice it's actually repeating the same list of 10 or 15 stars, because of course it has to go back and catch a system that's suddenly fainter than it was 20 minutes ago. And it's that real-time trigger that allows us to get out to the habitable zone. Oh, good Lord, I don't have a clue which of these I want. Okay, good enough. Okay, we're good. Okay, and M dwarfs are very spotty, but they're spotty over different time scales. That shouldn't scare you, because sun-like stars are spotty. The photometric modulation of the sun due to spots greatly exceeds the transit signal associated with the Earth. Okay, but that didn't stop Kepler, because it's a different time scale. Okay, that's the way you make. So this is the exact same idea. M dwarfs have big photometric modulations, but not over a one-hour time scale. And that's what we need to be sensitive to find transiting planets. So here's an example where, you know, this is a variability of one of our stars due to spots. It's a star that we care a lot about. These six red points probably wouldn't have caught your eye if we hadn't painted them red. But when we filter them, okay, then they do appear to be the lowest points, and then we identify a consistent period. Okay, so this first MIRTH discovery, the super Earth GJ1214, was identified with six data points. Okay, and so we found our first transiting super Earth, JJ1214. Here are the data. Out of interest, we can take MIRTH and point all eight telescopes at this target. And the photometry we get is better than using a 1.2 meter telescope, because we have the same aperture, but it's dispersed. So we beat the scintillation. It's really neat. Anyway, and so the point is, why am I excited? Oh, and then we worked, and we happened to find something that's equatorial. So we call up our friends in Geneva, said, do you have a spectrograph that could get, and they said, yes, we do. And lo and behold, so if I tell you the V-band magnitude, you would think can't be done. Okay, V-band of 15, V-band magnitude of 15, and it's just those red, that's why I asked Michelle earlier, it's just those redmost orders. That's where all the signal came from, that's where all the photons were. That allowed us to get the radial velocity of GJ1214. This was wonderful work done by Christoph Lovis and Xavier Bonfils and the whole HARPS team to really pull out the signal. And so we had this mass radius diagram, but all the stuff that's preoccupied us for the last 10 years is up there. Now we're down in this part, okay, and you've got the first MIRTH planet, GJ1214, okay, and in an indistinguishable mass, you have the first Corot planet. So what's exciting is that we now know that there's going to be a diversity of compositions at that mass range that HARPS has been telling us about. There's a whole bunch of things that are sort of 5 or 10 times the mass of the Earth. Well, it ain't going to be so easy. Some of them are going to be ice, and some of them are going to be rock. And I've overplotted the compositional models here. This is a pure water body. This is a silicate Earth-like composition. Okay. And so just the last idea I wanted to leave you with is, you know, putative models for GJ1214. Why I'm excited about 1214 is because it's so accessible to us. It's only 13 parsecs away. We can go ahead and study its atmosphere. So maybe you think, we measure the mean density. So the following three models I'm going to show are all consistent with that measurement. This is published by Rogers and Seeger. Maybe you think it's a mini Neptune, so it's a ball of ice surrounded by a primordial hydrogen-helium envelope. Maybe you think it's a water world, where it's a silicate with an ocean that then extends continuously into the atmosphere. Or maybe you think it's a rocky body that then outgassed a hydrogen atmosphere, which would be different because it'd be no helium, because helium isn't trapped in the rocky material. The point is, we can distinguish these using the Miller-Rickey method, which is basically you study the atmosphere in transmission, and that tells you the scale height. Because if there's no wavelength dependence to the inferred radius in transmission spectroscopy, then it implies that there isn't the substantial hydrogen and helium. If the atmosphere is a very small scale height, then there's nothing to see. It's gray, okay? And so there'd be no color dependence to the radius. And so what's just to show you how these super Earths are so accessible to us, because everything we've done everything in our favor to create systems, create discoveries that we knew would lead to spectroscopic follow-up. So we picked a tiny star, wanted nearby, the planet's a little big. Here predicted signal to noise you would get with every instrument, just T, and they all work, right? Here are the two Spitzer data, which are already scheduled. Those are not observations. They are theoretical calculations of the signal to noise. If there's substantial hydrogen and helium, here's what you would get with WIFC3, a combination of NICMOS and WIFC3, and even STIS down here. And so what we propose to do is actually measure these water bands. This doesn't really tell us about the presence of water so much as the presence of hydrogen, because it means that there's a substantial scale height. Okay? If indeed there's not this primordial hydrogen helium, if it's just a pure water body or a high mean molecular weight atmosphere, then the signal will be gray. So that's the experiment we're performing. Oh, and by the way, when we add up the photometry, the time series will allow us to find Ganymede. So I don't mean an analog, like a big analog of the Jovian satellites. I actually mean something the size of Ganymede. And again, it's because the star is 5 times smaller than the sun. So whereas before we were finding things the size of the Earth as satellites to gas giants, now we can truly find things that are 1/5 the size of the Earth. Okay, and so to end, what I want to say is that I think there's this big opportunity to move forward with finding planets around M-dwarfs. Obviously, we're getting ready to use JWST. We don't want to not have those targets ready. We've got to have these targets lined up so that we actually can observe them. And so I think there is this big opportunity to move forward with ground-based transit detection and mass determination, atmospheric characterization conducted by space. And I don't know if you're actually ready for this. This could happen in a year or two, okay? I mean, you know, there's lots of, and it's not just by MIRF. I mean, it could be the RV guys. They're going to find one and then just see how it transits. I think this is about to happen. And then I think we're talking about doing 5 years on with JWST. So I think there's a huge opportunity to actually look for biomarkers really in the next 5 years using this kind of different fast track approach. Thank you.
We open the paper up for questions.
Can you tell us the ages of these M stars?
Okay, so the ages of M stars. Let's see. So no. Let's see. Come on up here, showman. So the way that we learn about the ages of Sun-like stars is by looking at their evolutionary state. And the trouble, as you know, with M dwarfs is that they don't evolve. So it's very hard for us to distinguish whether it's 5 or 10 or 20, although that's unlikely, billion years old. So what we can do is rule out that they're very young. So we can certainly tell you that the M dwarf is older than 500 million years because of its activity indicators. Okay, so you can look at the activity and you can say, okay, this really doesn't look like a young M dwarf. Furthermore, we can look at the kinematics and say, look, does it really look like a peer of the solar system in terms of its motions throughout the galaxy, or does it actually look substantially younger, okay, based on its relative kinematics? But those are great for a population, but they're not great when applied to individual objects.
No questions back there?
Hi, David. Great talk. I wanted to ask you, do you already have some sort of ideas of how many planets are as interesting, like GJ 1412b you will find in the next 5 years?
Okay? Yes, yeah. So we thought a lot about that. So we're going to expand MIRF. We're going to go to the southern hemisphere. We have that money lined up already. And the reason is our goal is not to find 20 systems. It's to find the closest transiting systems to the Earth. And those ain't going to change. So we want to find them. And we want to do that before JWST launches. What Zach has done is looked at all the data, injected signals like 1214, and said, in how many of those would I have found this system in the way I did? Where's Scott? Normally Scott fusses at me about this kind of stuff. I would like to convince you maybe over lunch that that's a much better posed problem for MIRTH because it's a volume limited target sample and there are really no false positives and we didn't go into that. So Zach found that the fact that we found one within the first 6 months implies a rate of occurrence of 30%. Okay, but because it's one object, the 90% confidence interval on that isn't very interesting. What we want to do now is activate our real-time trigger. So what we relied on for 1214 was the phase full data, where we had to see three or four events, six data points spread over three transits. What we want to do is get this real-time trigger going so that in real time, the data are analyzed in real time, we're confident enough to trigger the observatory to go and confirm that there's an egress. And so that allows us to leapfrog out from 2-day orbital periods to 10-day orbital periods. And that allows us to actually get out of the habitable zone as well as catch many more planets. So once we implement that, then the detections per unit time should increase substantially. And so we're beginning to experiment with that now. But I would say it's always going to be sort of a handful of objects in the next few years, that these will always remain the most interesting ones for M-dwarfs.
Isabel.
Yes, Dave. So just to be a bit provocative, you said that people working on the theory have not done their job. But can we be sure that observers are doing their correctly? And I'm thinking, for example, it's just titillating you, yeah. But I'm thinking, for example, in the problem of the limb darkening coefficients that Antonio Clary mentioned last year, and rising the point that they may be very incorrect. And for example, on the analysis of the transiting light curve of HD209458, this could result in an uncertainty in the planetary radius of about 30%. So if you have any comments.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm not sure where that statement's coming from. The uncertainty in the limb darkening of 209458 cannot be a 30% error in the radius. It is true that if one assumes a limb darkening, one might underestimate the uncertainty in the radius. Generally, what good observers do is they also allow those parameters to float, and then they do this in a Markov chain Monte Carlo and see what by allowing the limb darkening to float, how much the radius uncertainty expands, and then they might publish that more conservative value. But even with good photometry, multiband photometry, letting that float, it's not ever a dominant source of error. It certainly cannot be anything like 30%.
Jill and then James Show.
Is there any hope to look for transit detections in young clusters, let's say a few million year old clusters? Because it'd be very interesting to find out what the radius of an exoplanet is when it's still in a stage where where the contraction is still substantial, or are young clusters too faint, too far away to look for detections?
Yeah, so the idea of looking for transiting planets in young clusters has been with us since the beginning. There was a paper, I think, in 1996 by Ken James at Boston University, which talked about that. And many folks here have been involved in that. And the basic problem is that most open clusters don't have enough stars for us to actually find a substantial number of planets, let alone a statistically interesting number of planets. So there haven't been any found in clusters convincingly. Most open clusters might only have, say, a few thousand stars, the ones that are close enough to us. And you really need order of magnitude more stars to be finding these transiting hot Jupiters. So it's a lovely experiment because the magnitude of the star tells you the mass of the star based on your evolutionary models and so on. And the fainter stars are okay because they're smaller. You know that those means they're smaller, and so you sort of maintain a good sensitivity across the main sequence and so on. But it hasn't panned out, and that's because there really aren't enough nearby cluster stars. Well, it is a question. I mean, at some point we can't do it if the stars are too faint. We certainly can't do the Doppler confirmation. So we're sort of limited to nearby clusters, and it's been a little frustrating, I think.
Hi, Dave. James Cho.
Hey.
I have a comment rather than a question, and that's you mentioned several important parameters in the earlier part of your talk. such as density and radius. And I might add, it'd be nice to have an independent measurement of the rotation rate of the planet. Can you say something about that, please?
Yeah, sure. So you're asking to measure the rotation period of the planet. Right, so you know, how is that done for Jupiter? It's done with, I believe, with radio signals. Well, no, it's not by looking at the spot. It's not by looking at features on Jupiter. It's actually the modulation and the log wavelength emission, I believe. So is that, Dave would know that. Yeah, so the point is that, you know, you could imagine doing something like that. There's been attempts to actually see the analog of Jupiter's emission. We don't quite have the sensitivity, but that's something worth pursuing for the future. And that would give you, you know, if you could see some kind of modulation. You know, certainly for the what's been done, as you know, is for the closed-in systems, we're assuming that they're tidally locked. And then we can see that there are features on the planet, as we'll hear about later, that do match the orbital period. So that, but that doesn't, you know, that's not an independent evidence of the thing that you seek. But that's consistent with this picture. Of course, you know, that's a difficult thing to go after, but I think there's avenues for someone to take a stab and really directly measure the rotation periods of these planets in the next few years, maybe at long wavelengths. Yeah. Well, I should mention the oblateness stuff. There was one way to go after it is we have such good data that we can actually see if the planets are oblate, and so presumably that constrains the rotation period, right? If you assume some composition and density profile.
Anybody want to comment on that comment?
Well, yeah, and I'll invite actually some of the authors are sitting here. Okay, so Josh is who did some of that. We'll talk about it.
Comment on that comment.
Oh.
Because you know, of course, Jupiter and Saturn has different oblateness, but their rotation rate is about the same. So I'm not sure you're going to be able to necessarily figure out the degeneracy.
Right, but we could presumably rule out rapidly rotating scenarios by observing that there's no oblateness to some precision. So and that would then argue for this idea that they are tidally locked, and therefore rotate about 10 times slower than Jupiter at these hot Jupiter periods.
Questions? More questions and comments? Okay, we're just about on time, so let's thank Dave and all the speakers this morning. And the first speaker of the afternoon will be starting speaking at 2:00.